Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to The Future of Food, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. The Cherry Bomb team toured America last year and visited lots of great cities, from Detroit to Seattle to Dallas, to ask women what the future of food means to them. Throughout this series, you're going to hear talks and panels that we recorded on each stop. You'll hear from chefs, bakers, farmers, and even some vegan ice cream entrepreneurs. These members of the Bomb Squad share their vision for what's next, in their world and the world around them. I hope this series inspires you to stop and think about your future. For this episode, we're traveling to Chicago, Illinois. Our event was held at the St. Jane Hotel in downtown Chicago. We're going to kick things off with Krishan Lampley, founder of the wine company Love Cork Screw. But first, thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and this miniseries. Kerrygold is the iconic Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese made with milk from grass-fed cows. Before we go to Krishan, let's check in with Kerrygold. There are so many things you can do with cheese beyond just making a cheese board, and who knows that better than a cheesemaker? We checked back in with Sarah Furno, the farmhouse cheesemaker whose family created the famous Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. We asked Sarah for some of her favorite ways to cook with Kerrygold cheese.
There's loads of different ways. If I'm with my kids, we might be making pizza with like a quattro formaggio with, you know, Cashel Blue and maybe some, you know, some aged Kerrygold cheddar and some mozzarella, or I might pop it into a risotto. I love making inverted burgers for friends if they come over.
Inverted burger? I've never heard of that. Stay tuned to hear Sarah explain exactly how she makes this inventive burger with Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. Interested in putting your own spin on dishes with Kerrygold's award-winning butter and cheese? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com for recipes and inspiration. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. Here's Krishan Lampley of Love Cork Screw explaining why she's a unicorn.
So what the heck am I, right? You think, do I own a vineyard? I'm an négociant. So what does that mean? That means that the vineyards actually produce the wine for me. So I'm a chemist, if you will. So each varietal that I produce is my own. It's Love Cork Screw. That's simple, right? So imagine starting off in this industry. I've been in sales and marketing about 20 years now. I've owned Love Cork Screw since 2013. So imagine entering the industry as a unicorn. So I say the future of food is being a unicorn. A unicorn, you say? Yeah, I'm a self-proclaimed unicorn. How so? So as an African-American woman négociant, I account for less than 1% of the industry. So let's really break that down. Documented, there's only 60 of us out of 111,000 in the world. Kind of a unicorn, right? So what does that mean, 60? There's 60 of us that own private labels or négociants or own a vineyard or a private label. 60. So each time I walk into a room, whether it be a meeting with vineyard owners, meeting with different accounts, meeting with my distributors, they think I'm the promotional girl. I'm just the face of the brand, right? There's no way I own a company. She doesn't own a vineyard. I'm the owner. So let's backtrack to losing my gallery. I lost my gallery because of a flood due to baby wipes. Imagine losing your business from baby wipes, huh? So the condo owners above our storefront flushed non-biodegradable baby wipes down the toilet. And that backed up into our storefront. So imagine walking into 2 inches of sewer water. And for you that own brick and mortar, you know, dram shop insurance, you think it covers baby wipes? Nah. So I was about 2 days from losing my home, losing everything because I had everything connected to an SBA loan, right? Personal guarantee back in those days. So lost everything, and I said, for some reason, my heart's still beating. So I need to continue. What am I gonna do? Oh, I'm gonna start another business. I'm crazy, right? And I did, 2013, started Love Corkscrew. I'm in likes of Whole Foods, Mariano's, Target, over 75,000 bottles of Love Corkscrew sold to date. Thank you, thank you. The catch though, That's not a lot at all, right? That's not a lot at all. This girl from Chicago actually grew up in Downers Grove. This girl from Chicago. Oh, there's Downers Grove. Downers Grove South. Okay. Years ago, though, I came out in 92. I'm showing my age now. So I'm this girl from Chicago, yet I'm flying to Harvest. I just got back from Harvest Summit. I'm going to all these cool places with sommeliers, other negociants, and they're like, who the heck is this girl? How'd she do this from Chicago? So I say that to say that being a woman within this industry, in whatever industry you're in, most likely you're going to quake for a very small percentage, right? So I always say, what makes you so special? Now think about that. What makes you so special? So you go and complain all the time, every day, and you're not getting the right opportunities. Oh, woe is me. Sorry, look at here. You think I get any opportunities? Hardly any. But I say to myself, you know what? I'm gonna use that and use that in a positive light because it's gonna make me work harder. It's gonna make me do more. So I don't have to say when I walk in the room, I'm the owner. No, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna listen. I'm gonna learn. I'm gonna take all of that information in and I'm gonna become better. So by the time I'm leaving that meeting, they're like, wait a minute. You own Love Corkscrew, don't you? I said, yeah, I do. So I end this with saying, the future is definitely knowing that you can do better in whatever that is. That's number one, do better. Always go above and beyond and know that you're always going to have to be the best at it just to be considered equal, if you understand that. Lastly, I always say that you can't follow your passion. Your passion actually follows you. What does that mean? For bakers here, right? You know people who just love cooking. They love baking and they suck at it, right? The food is absolutely horrible, but they're very passionate about it. Then there's singers, right? Ooh, you just thought you just blew, right? You're actually tone deaf, but you're passionate about it, but you're not good at it. So could I have told you 20 years ago I was gonna be a negociant? Yeah, right. No, but I take everything that happened, I realize, oh wait, kind of been in sales and marketing for 20 something years. I kind of get along with just about everybody. I said, wait a minute, this is something that's just normal to me that everybody looks at and says, well, that's just you, Krishan. Well, look it, my passion followed me and it followed me into something that I love. And I love being a unicorn and the future is being more and being better.
Let's raise a glass to Krishan Lampley for all that inspiration. Next, we're going to hear from Maggie Hennessy, the restaurant and bar critic for Time Out Chicago. Maggie, who is also a Cherry Bomb contributor, talks about something near and dear to us, the future of food journalism.
So I'm Maggie Hennessy, the restaurant and bar critic for Time Out Chicago. I'm also a freelance food and drink journalist. I'm here to tell you about what being a freelance food writer means at this very moment and what I hope the future holds, because the importance of good journalism extends to food too, and there's a lot at stake. In the 13 years I've been a mostly food journalist, I've been on staff at 5 different publications, survived 2 magazine closures that resulted in the loss of my job, watched mastheads shrink and fat magazines get really skinny. I had just finished culinary school when Gourmet magazine folded, and that one hurt. I've been a full-time freelance food writer since 2014. I'm fortunate to have a life partner who supported us at the beginning when I couldn't find steady work. Now I divide my time between testing chef recipes for Chicago magazine, running around town talking to people who know way more about wine than I do, calling chefs to ask about bootstrapping their first restaurant, cooking with beer, or whether or not they serve veal, and furiously writing on the floor of my apartment, pants optional. Every other week, I sneak into a new restaurant or bar and decide if it's a place all of you should visit too. I use a fake name, but I don't wear a disguise, except one place where I wore like a felt Indiana Jones hat and I got really sweaty because I was also wearing a turtleneck. I like listening in on other people's conversations for color. Sometimes I stay for extra wines that I pay for out of my pocket. Often I get to interview the chef or bartender a few days later to ask if they actually did put cheese in that shrimp dish. No. what made their XO sauce taste so damn beguiling in Duya, or how they managed to make a Cosmo that didn't taste like sadness, a Ronia liqueur. Then I get really awkward and I tell them how my review turned out. I'm allowed to accept media dinner invites to supplement critic visits, but I don't anymore because it's unfair to the restaurants without PR representation, since I only have a budget to go once. These are the sorts of ethical jams I work through with fellow writers or the mister, or if no one else is around, my dog Penny, but she hears all my ideas anyway because working from home makes you talk to yourself more, along with a litany of other creepy habits. 5 years in, I'm doing all right, making close to what I did as a full-time writer. Plus, I like life way more. I constantly toggle between chasing stories I love and those that pay the bills, which are rarely the same. I don't pitch often enough because it's dreadful. I don't tell every story the way it deserves to be told. I don't always get to eat at the places I write stories about. I don't catch every opening. I've misspelled names, fucked up titles, and opening dates, and once mistook chicken for pork, but to be fair, it was really good chicken. When you work for yourself, you become painfully aware of the concept of time as currency. For instance, my porn is deep dive storytelling, but as a writer, I often can't afford to justify the hours of research, interviews, and writing to do it properly when I know I'm getting a $150 fee out the other side. I'm not alone. Almost all writers at The New Yorker are independent contractors, meaning they don't qualify for healthcare or other benefits, despite being largely prevented from writing for other outlets. I'm heartened to see newsrooms from Vice to Slate to Tronc to Vox unionizing to protect journalists in these troubled times. But those protections don't extend to freelance writers. As more media brands have laid off big chunks of staff, they're more likely to hire part-timers, freelancers, interns, and permalancers, another great little term that's popped up, just to get content online for cheap. And there is always someone who will say yes to less money than you. The truth is, covering anything the way it should be covered, including food, is time-consuming and expensive. I'm not sure how many of you saw the movie Spotlight, which follows the Boston Globe Spotlight team that uncovered widespread child sex abuse by area Catholic priests, but it's an incredible example of what truly good journalism requires. You need patient publishers who pay in time and money for proper research, whether digging into decades of newspaper clippings or legal documents, soliciting Freedom of Information Act requests, knocking on door after door, getting several slammed in your face along the way. And that's all before you've even put pen to paper. Not to mention the supporting cast of fact checkers, photographers, production staff, ad sellers, social media, and of course, editors. The best writing you've ever read wouldn't have been so without good editing. Granted, I get that divulging a city's 5 best burger joints doesn't hold a candle to uncovering decades of abuse and cover-ups by the Catholic Church, but being careless always has a cost. Say a writer who's strapped for time uses previous coverage of an iconic bar as background. If that previous story's writer got the founding owner's name wrong and no one called to double-check, you can see how it becomes a gross little game of telephone with inaccurate reporting. The great thing about the internet is we can correct those errors super fast, but we lose credibility with readers each time. But I am no negative Nancy, and the future is bright. Chefs, sommeliers, writers, you name it, frustrated with existing food media, are starting rad small press magazines of their own, like Food and Queer Culture Mag Jari, Hospitality Focus Mag Counter Service, Food Origins Mag Whetstone. Oh, and you know, Cherry Bomb. And they pay their writers, even better. A 19-year-old Thai American college student at the University of Illinois started one of the most beautiful food mags I've ever seen, you know, with that like real sexy thick paper stock called Dill, which honors Asian foodways. All over, we're hearing more diverse stories and rightfully learning about food's intersections with politics, culture, and socioeconomic status. Chicago Tribune dining writer Louisa Chu extensively covered the ongoing fight against displacement and gentrification in Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood, where a handful of new restaurants have been at the crosshairs. Plate magazine editor Chandra Ram, who is here, she just released a marvelous Instant Pot cookbook in which she shares her story of imposter syndrome as a first-generation Indian American from Kentucky who reconnected to her heritage through a modern kitchen appliance that made Indian cooking accessible. Another fellow Chicagoan at the Red Eye, Sade Carpenter, regularly highlights local bartenders and chefs of color. Recently, after a reader tweeted about the lack of black-owned spots to support north of downtown, she compiled a list of 24 black-owned restaurants on the city's north side. On Thursday, Bonat published a beautiful piece about the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who worked in food service while running for office, and for whom food has always been inescapably political as the most tangible indicator of our social inequities. I'd like to see more advertisers throw their support behind work with a conscience, where there's evident care in the end product, where power is held to account, where underserved voices have a platform, and where recipes are reliable. I'd like to see readers invest in high-quality storytelling. So here's my plea. If there's a food media outlet you love and you have the means, show your support. Donate money or buy a print subscription and feel that sexy cardstock between your fingers. If a magazine you like puts on events or, I don't know, opens a timeout food hall, go. If one of its contributors writes a cookbook or a city guide, buy one. The people in this room give me hope because you're here. And as did watching the rise of our own neighborhood news site, Block Club Chicago, like a phoenix from the ashes of DNA info this spring. I was glued to Twitter as they broke fundraising goal after goal, weeping openly while I cried out to the Mister, people care. We have to show that we value quality storytelling if we want it to survive. Because at the end of the day, we're all part of this community. Writers are the archivists and storytellers, uncovering the truth and speaking for the unheard. But they're human. So if you're a member of a group that's underrepresented or notice an injustice yet uncovered, or if there's simply a place where you love to eat that needs some love in return, tell me. I may only be one dudette who can't always tell if she's eating chicken or pork, but I got good ass editors. Thank you.
Thank you to Maggie Hennessy. As Maggie said, don't let good journalism disappear. Find a way to support your favorite publications. And to all of you listening, thank you for supporting Cherry Bomb. Before we get to our panel, let's return to my chat with Sarah Furno, the farmhouse cheesemaker whose family created the award-winning Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese. I know you're all eager to hear more about this inverted burger. I certainly am. You're definitely going to want to make this recipe this weekend. Here's farmhouse cheesemaker Sarah Furno describing her go-to recipe that includes Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese.
I buy some good quality ground steak mince. I will sweat off a small amount of diced onion and just mix that in with the ground mince. And then I take a small amount of blue cheese and I make a hole in the burger patty and pop it into the center and just close it back up. And then as the burger is cooking, of course, the blue cheese melts in the center. So when you bite into your burger, you've got a little sauce, a little surprise.
And who doesn't want that?
It captures the flavor of the cheese very well and just adds a complementary element to the burger. So it works well. It's good. It's very easy as well.
Want to make your own inverted burger with Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish farmhouse cheese? Visit KerrygoldUSA.com to find out where you can purchase their award-winning butter and cheese. That's KerrygoldUSA.com. It's time to hear from our panel. These four women are contributing to the Chicago area's very happening food scene. Baker Ellen King, the co-founder of Hewn Bread in Evanston, Chef Beverly Kim of Parachute, Fat Rice co-owner Adrian Lowe, and Christine Sikowski, the co-founder of Honey Butter Fried Chicken. Let's go right to Christine, who answers the question, what is the first thing that comes to mind when you think about the future of food?
So the first one that comes to mind is less food waste. And that's a subject that has always been really super important to me. And I really do see us going in that direction. I think that it's economical, it's social, it's practical, logical, all the things. And, you know, we have so many people that are like starving in this country and so much food goes in the trash. And so I think it's something that chefs are very conscious of because of food costs. I mean, just like practical speaking, like we run businesses. We're not just romantically cooking and that doesn't cost money. It does. But like we're very conscious about what we put in the trash and how we reuse everything. But I think I would love to see more attention paid to that just sort of trickling down to the public. And we can set the example, but having it be part of our food culture as Americans, I think, is what I would like to see for just first. There's other things, but that one first.
Adrian? I mean, I definitely agree. Food waste is a huge thing. I think we're very conscious of that at Fat Rice. I like to think of us as a very low to no waste restaurant, for sure. But I think a huge thing is also making sure that we're eating local and supporting local. Again, I feel like the majority of the food in the grocery stores are processed foods that have added sugar to everything. And I really think we need to move away from that. I mean, just from a health standpoint, but also I think for the continued progress of our world and our society to be able to actually eat real food.
Beverly.
What I would like to see in the future is more focus on a balanced, more family-friendly kind of lifestyles. But I think it would require for all the consumers to know what's going on behind the scenes, mm-hmm. and for the consumers to understand how it breaks down. And it might require people to, and if people see how it's broken down, they might consider restructuring things, like restructuring how we are looking at hospitality, how we're paying everybody, because it wasn't fun being pregnant and, you know, going back to work in 6 weeks. And that's why, you know, I took risks to go on Top Chef and things and to further my career. But I think for most women, why, not just women, but even men, it's a very difficult field, and to have a family life. And if we are willing to pay more for food, if we're willing to pay more for a better lifestyle, like, we have the highest number of minimum wage workers in any industry. So just food for thought.
You and I have talked a lot about the tipping issue. And Christine, I know you have no tipping, right, at your establishment?
Yeah, we actually eliminated tips after our first year of business. And we do what we're kind of following the Union Square hospitality model of hospitality included. So we did raise our prices a little bit to kind of help offset that. But yeah, we just basically say everything is included in the price of your food. And our workers don't work for tips.
All right. Your turn.
All right. I think that the future of food is actually, I'm a history geek, so I actually think it lies in getting back in touch with our historical roots. So by that, I mean, for us at our bakery, it's our mission to source locally grown, organic, and sustainable grains, but not just conventional varieties. We really work very hard with farmers to source heritage varieties, because we need to increase the biodiversity of our wheat that's being grown, in addition to our beans and our corn. So for me, the history is honestly spending time in farm journals and looking at varieties in our region and in other regions that grew successfully in the 1800s and 1900s. So kind of more like a little more academic, but that's where I think the future is.
Ellen, have you found many willing farmer partners to do this with?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the speaker before talking about unicorns, because I used to call my grain farmers that I found, like Andy Hazard, one that I connected with 4 years ago. I was like, it's like meeting a unicorn, because she's a female and she's a grain farmer, and she was willing to grow a bunch of different varieties she was already growing, but then she was willing to grow a heritage variety that we kind of worked on a project together. So they're slowly coming. I think the biggest thing was the fear of the demand, because farming is basically a 3-year process, right? So they want to make sure that in 3 years, essentially, when they have a crop big enough, they'll have someone to buy it.
That's great. All right. So, Christine, we're going to go back to you and food waste. Such a big deal. I think I've read numbers like a third of all garbage is food waste.
I think that there's a couple of pronged approaches to it. Obviously, like learning and teaching people how to use all the parts of the ingredients. And that starts, I think, with children. I'm part of an organization called Pilot Light that like goes into schools and like teaches kids about beets and not just like, you know, like not just hamburgers, like where the meat comes from, and it comes from animals. Like, so educating the next generation, I think, is going to help with that a lot. Something that I would love to see happen, maybe just even locally, that's happening way on the West Coast, a little more progressive, I think, is if you're going to have food waste, that it should be composted. I think that not having a citywide composting program is like, seems insane to me.
When I lived in Seattle, I mean, it was almost a decade ago now, they had transitioned back then. All food waste had to be composted, even at your home. So it was like you had a little tiny, like almost like an office garbage can size for your waste.
That's what it's like everything. In Portland. Like you have like two, every family, it's like two, don't quote me on this, I think it's two, or one huge one, big one for composting, and then they get picked up like 3 days a week, and then like the garbage gets picked up like once a day a week. And, like, it's a competition. Like, I don't have any garbage. You know, we can all do our individual parts, but like at Honey Butter, we've chosen to like compost our packaging, but it it really puts us at a competitive disadvantage. It costs us so much money to pay services to compost, and like the packaging's more expensive. And it's like, we do it because it's the right thing to do, but trying to get everybody on board with it like would lower the cost significantly. And it's just a theme that we sort of will come back to about tipping and benefits. It's like, we do all these things in various forms, all of us, but if not everybody's doing it, then our businesses suffer because it costs us more money to run our businesses. So I think with the food waste in particular, like taking a bigger approach with the public and just educating people about how to use it, but then also what to do with it when you have waste, and like composting, I think is probably the easiest answer for that.
There's such a big education component to it. I think a lot of people just don't know how to recycle and how to compost. And I'm sort of a militant composter, and often my freezer will be filled with more compost than actual food. And then I'll see my boyfriend put something in the compost bin, and I'm just like, oh my God, what did he just put in the compost bin?
Every time my cooks put one of those like blue gloves in the compost, I'm like, I'm gonna kill you. Right. That's the earth. And they're like, there she goes. But they all get on board with it too. But yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, it's like a murderous rage over compost. So, all right. So supporting local, such a big deal. How is the scene here? I mean, I know we've got people like Maggie whose whole existence is about supporting the local food scene. But how are things in Chicago in terms of the support
get? I think we have a pretty great community as far as local farmers and supporting local small businesses. I mean, for us at Fat Rice, which is the food that we cook, is definitely not seasonal per se, as far as, again, its history and everything, but we really work towards, obviously during the summertime is when you can take the most advantage of it, but really trying to, again, work with local farmers, you know, get local dairy and eggs and utilize that in our food. We have, I feel like, great relationships with, you know, all the farmers here. And again, we've made huge efforts to continue to, you know, support the people that are here. Again, to keep their business thriving, because if they're gone, I mean, it hurts us as well. So for a cuisine that is 500 years old and has nothing to do with seasonal ingredients.
Tell us about the cuisine.
So I don't know if any of you have been there, but what we do at Fat Rice is kind of started off with the cuisine of Macau. Some of you may know of it as the Las Vegas of the East. It's like does 10 times what Las Vegas does. And it just, that is unfortunately continuing to grow and grow and grow. The casino world is overtaking this beautiful little enclave right off the coast of Hong Kong. Again, 500 years ago, kind of the world was split between Spanish and Portuguese sailors and traders, and the Portuguese went east and the Spanish went west, and the last place that the Portuguese ended up was in Macau. Again, it was a time everybody was looking for what was gold back then, which is spices, you know, the spice trade. And so the food that we do is really built within heritage family recipes. And again, these people, these sailors that were traveling across the world, these, again, dangerous, I can't even imagine, you know, being on boats for months. But it's a really beautiful combination of mostly like Portuguese, and there was stops through South America, Brazil, South Africa, through Goa, India, through Malacca, Malaysia, and even up to Nagasaki in Japan. Finally, the last place was Macau. So again, you see this beautiful fusion of Portuguese ingredients culminating together with, again, ingredients from across the globe. So it's really kind of a beautiful thing that people are like, I'm going to Macau, where should I go eat? And I'm like, there's like nowhere to find actual true Macanese fusion food there. If you're interested in it, you have to actually go to somebody's house, which we were fortunate enough to do, to meet people in Macau, go to their houses, cook with them, go to the markets, and learn directly from these amazing families that have long histories in Macau. My business partner, the chef, is Portuguese American. I'm Chinese American. I spent some time in India. He spent time through Brazil. And we traveled to China together and to Macau. And it really just kind of was a beautiful combination of who we are as individuals, where we had traveled, and kind of the places we had gone together.
Before we go back to Beverly, I'm so fascinated by this underground food culture. And I chatted with a few of you beforehand. Yours is the only one that's still around. But I get the sense that you did it because it's so hard to just leap right into the brick and mortar world, that you start with these underground clubs to sort of find an audience, maybe raise money. I mean, Ella, why did you do yours?
No, I didn't want to start a business, actually. I left the food world when I moved from Seattle to Chicago with a young son, and I didn't want to work in restaurants anymore. But I think I realized I was depressed, and I wasn't a baker either. I was like all savory in Seattle. But when you have a young son and you don't know anybody and the winters are really long here, I became obsessed with the bread that I missed eating. So it was like kind of a hobby that just became like therapy, really, because you know, you talked about having pets that you have at home. My starter became my pet, and it like became my sanity because I would talk to my starter and my son, who was like two, and I'd just be like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Wait, have you seen that video series about My Life in Sourdough? Has anybody seen that?
No.
The French girl who has had, like, she's in love with her. Like, she's dating her starter.
Okay. Yeah. That didn't happen for me. But, yeah, so my business literally started because I wanted to get better at doing bread, and I wasn't tasting the way I wanted it to from when I had lived in Europe and in Seattle. And, you know, I say that whenever you have an addiction, you have to become a dealer, right? So I quickly became a dealer and got my son hooked in to sell the bread at his preschool. And then we would like travel around on my bike and he'd be in the little burly buried under bread. And I mean, we're talking, he's like 4 years old and he was the money man. So he'd like run up and deliver the bread and I'd keep the bike because the squirrels here are crazy, right? Like insane. So if we left the bike, there'd be like a squirrel sitting in the burly. But so from that, literally Julie, who's here, my business partner in the bakery, she was a customer and was just like, you've got to open something. And it'd been about 3 years and I was maxed out. I couldn't do it at home anymore. It was insane. But I never wanted to open my own place because I knew what it meant, that I would have no life. And that times like 10, except I guess I have a life because I'm up here, which is cool. So there are some perks to it. But yeah, that's my story.
All right, Beverly, we are going to switch to you because you want to make the food world better for women working in this industry. So as does everyone who's up here, but I know this is a passion of yours. So tell us what you're doing to be the change you want to see.
Well, okay, so we've been open for 5 years, and well, since we turned a profit, one of the first things I felt bad about was I went from Medicaid to getting my own health insurance, and I felt like, shit, I'm getting my own health, I feel really selfish, you know? And so we've implemented a group health insurance program, which we started off giving $150 per person flat across the board. And then if you're a manager for 3 years, we take care of all of your health insurance, which is a lot for, I think we have 25 employees altogether. We started with 7 employees when we opened Parachute. But I think that was always a concern for me because I remember when I was like a cook and I didn't have enough money to pay the bills and I was constantly like holding in my pee all day. And like, I just always had this compassion for what it's like to be in this industry. I wish I could pay like middle in class income wage for, it's just not, cooks are not middle class. You're kind of like as a cook, you know, trying to find yourself. And I think, you know, people are like, why are there not a lot of women? It's just a damn hard job, you know, for very little wage. And I met my husband through our love for Korean food. So that's why we're a Korean American restaurant, but he's not Korean. He's originally from Cincinnati, but I was not a good Korean daughter, not a good Korean daughter. We had a shotgun wedding because I got pregnant when I was 30. Yeah, we had our wedding like when I was on the hotline at Tekashi's at 6 months pregnant, and I realized I couldn't do this anymore, and that's when I applied to Whole Foods because they had benefits, and Tekashi's, it's a small Michelin star Japanese restaurant, and he's like, you don't want to stay with us? I was like, yeah. I need my benefits, you know, but it was really tough. And I just have a lot of compassion because the only reason I stuck with it is because I'm
crazy. I'm not mentally altered, you know? So you gotta be kind of crazy. And well, not only that, but it's the only thing I know how to do. Since I was 16 cooking, and now I'm like already in my 30s, like what else am I gonna do? You know, I love this. And I love it, but I hate it. It's just not paying the bills, you know? And well, it's not about paying the bills, you just learn how to live under $30,000 a year. And if you live under $30,000 a year in Chicago, it's tough. You learn how to do that, but it's not great. And you know, you wonder why there's all these mental health issues with cooks and stuff. So nothing felt great until opening our own restaurant. And even though we opened our own restaurant, we still work like crazy. I've always committed to not, even though it was tempting to open Sunday. So we always close Sundays and Mondays, so none of our sous chefs ever, managers ever have to work 6 days or 7 days or whatever, 14 days sometimes places have to work. And also our managers actually work 4 full days and a half day. So we've cut down the managers from working 60, our back of the house cooks, back of the house managers from working 60 plus hours in the kitchen to working to more like 48 to 53 per week. And they are so much happier. And their half day that they come in for a little bit is just focused on creativity. Because if you can't pay awesome, I think what you need to give your cooks is a culture of learning and education and something that they can really value.
I have one more question for Christine, because you have eliminated tipping. You have a service charge, right?
No. We don't have a service charge.
You added it to your food cost.
So we're a different kind of, we're not a table service restaurant. We don't really have servers per se. We have people that run the food to the tables. So it's a little different. We don't present
places
checks.
Still put a tip jar.
Yeah, they put a tip jar, they add a service charge on the check, and we just decided that we were just going to include it in the price of the food. So like, it's just like one price. That's what you get. And when you come in Honey Butter, you get food, you get service, and you get to be a part of this community that supports local farmers, that composts, that pays PTO, health benefits, paid parental leave for all of our employees. That covers everything. Yeah, and I just think that we just decided that we just didn't want our customers to decide what kind of money our employees make. What's hard about it is that not everybody does it. And I think most restaurateurs that I've talked, Bev and I have talked about this a lot, would love to get rid of it. But unless everybody gets rid of it, it's just not going to ever work because we're operating at a competitive disadvantage. Most servers want to make $50 an hour. To let some people do it and not other people do it, it just, there's always going to be people, you're going to lose workers and not attract the same type of people. And like Bev said, we at Honey Butter attract people that, you know, maybe they're okay making a little bit less per hour because they love working for us and they have PTO and they, if they can have a baby and take 12 weeks off paid and come back and still have a job and only work 45 hours a week, 48 hours a week for managers, stuff like that. But yeah, it's just, until it's legislated across the country, like we're always going to suffer a little bit for it, but I just think it's the right thing to do. And I don't want to put my employees in a situation where they will give different service to customers based on what they think they're going to get tipped. And as much as I'd like to believe that everyone gets tipped the same, it just isn't true. White people get tips more money and so do men. And that's just a fact. And we just didn't want them to have to do things to get more tips and favor certain customers. And we're like, we're the only industry in America that like lets customers decide how much. Like, you don't go to the Apple store and like tip the, they just, the phone's $700 and like that covers everything. And you don't tip your doctor. And like, I just don't understand it.
Well, I think the good news is the people on this panel and who have spoken and who are part of the Cherry Bomb universe really represent change. And I think what all of you are doing is so remarkable. And, you know, when you talk about being the change that you want to see in the world, I really do think all four of you represent that. And Maggie, you and Krishan also. Thank you to all of you. As we always like to say, you're the bomb.
Thank you to our speakers and panelists for such an inspiring evening. I hope they gave you a lot of food for thought. Thank you to the St. Jane Hotel for hosting us. If you are planning a trip to Chicago, be sure to check out the St. Jane Hotel. Our show was produced by Jess Seidman and supported by Kerrygold. Thank you for listening to the Future of Food miniseries. Here's to a delicious tomorrow.